Working Cows Podcast, Episode 20.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
This episode has been brought to you in part by Kamak Ranch Supply. Check out their website at kamakranchsupply.com. This episode is also brought to you by chriswilliamsaudio.com. Head on over to chriswilliamsaudio.com for all your audio production needs. Hello, everybody. This is Clay Connery, the host of the Working Cows Podcast. Really excited today to bring you a very special guest. Jim Garish is my guest today. Jim's experience includes over 20 years of beef forage systems research and outreach while on the faculty of the University of Missouri, as well as 20 years of commercial cattle and sheep production on their family farm in northern Missouri. The University of Missouri Forage Systems Research Center rose to national prominence as a result of his research leadership. His research encompassed many aspects of plant-soil-animal interactions and provides foundation for many of the basic principles of management-intensive grazing. It is my pleasure to welcome to the show Jim Garish. Jim, thank you for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast. It's an honor to have you on. I'd like to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself and tell people about what you're doing now and how it is you came to be doing that.
Well, Clay, thanks for the opportunity to join you and share some of this with your listeners. So, I'm Jim Garish. A lot of people are familiar with my name and my work. I've been involved in the grazing world for, it's almost too long to figure. Almost 40 years. So a little bit of background, because you indicated you wanted to talk about our Kick the Hay Habit book and the idea of year-round grazing. So I did grow up on a farm in southern Illinois, and I grew up in the hay business. Paid for my first 4 years of college with custom hay baling. I got to say, I loved the smell of hay. I enjoyed the work. And just as years rolled by and I worked in the grazing arena, really came to the realization that making and feeding hay is just no longer a cost-effective practice, particularly in the beef business. So I spent 22 years, 3 months on the University of Missouri faculty working primarily in grazing research. In 2003, I quit the university. Sometimes I get introduced as being a retired professor. Obviously, I'm way too young to be retired. So I quit the university, went into private business, into consulting business. I do a lot of workshops, seminars, speak at conferences all around the country and overseas. And most of it is geared towards how do we become more effective and efficient grazers, and how can we get the high cost and time-consuming process of making hay out of our farming and ranching operations. So there it is in a nutshell.
Very good. Thank you. Appreciate that introduction. That'll be lay a good foundation for where we're hoping to go today as we examine kind of an introduction to the ideas contained in your book, Kick the Hay Habit, which will be linked at the show notes page for the Working Cows podcast. It'll be at workingcows.net/20, workingcows.net/20. So if you want to check that out, buy Jim's book or any of his other books, feel free to head on over there and check that out. So as I prepared today, refamiliarizing myself with the things contained in your book, there was an interesting nugget there that I think I would like to just get some of the background story on. It says one of your big days when you were at the University of Missouri Forage Systems Research Center was your heyday. And I wanted to, you said that you and no longer in good conscience could continue to encourage farmers and ranchers to buy hay equipment. Your culture was beginning to change. Can you tell me about that, kind of the backstory and how that happened and what you were seeing that caused you to feel that way and to think that way?
Okay. Well, I started at the University of Missouri in 1981, and Heyday had already been going on for several years at that research station before I was ever involved there. And when I started out, it was a fun day. It was a great day. You got to see all the new equipment. We got to try things out. A lot of times the manufacturers would leave equipment, new equipment, for us to try out. And yeah, it was fun and exciting, and it was our big social event of the year. I was still, on the same page as the mainstream of the industry that paying was just something that had to be done. As we advanced our research studies, and then also, I should also mention that all the years that I was on the faculty at University of Missouri, except for the first year and a half, but all the rest of the time, we had our own farm, and we grew that farm over the years. We ran cattle there, we ran sheep, and I quit making and feeding hay on our own farm before we moved that direction at the university. Why was I so motivated to do it on our own farm? Because I was the one paying the bills. And with where cattle prices were and the cost of making the hay in my own operation, it no longer made sense. And so at the research station, we started doing more with stockpile grazing, increasing the intensity of management, the frequency of rotation, really learning how to tightly budget out feed. And we saw that it was so much better economics than the haymaking that we were locked into at the research station that we started making less and less hay, grazing more and more. And eventually, that's the story that we wanted to share with all the producers through our region who were coming to Heyday. And by continuing to host that Heyday, it was like we were giving tacit approval to this whole concept of making hay. And times were getting tougher and tougher in the agricultural economy. And so finally, we just, Dr. Marks and I, the superintendent, we just had the conversation and said, we can't really do this anymore. And so we shifted to doing the grazing schools. We began doing the 3-day grazing management schools at FSRC, the Forage Systems Research Center. We started doing that in 1989. And so that's about the time that we ended Heyday and we shifted into grazing management education.
Sure. Very, very good history there. I appreciate that. What were some of the benefits you started to notice initially as you shifted away from Heyday and shifted towards the haymaking culture, I guess, as you say in your book, and started to shift towards more grazing and some of those things?
Well, cost reduction was one of the obvious ones. That first and foremost, that's really why we got into the winter grazing and intensive management there. It was cost reduction. But in Missouri and much of the Midwest, it's really hard to put up quality hay. And if your base forage is already endophyte-infected tall fescue and you let that hay get to, full seed head because the weather's been too rainy and cloudy to make hay, then you mow it down. It gets rained on 3 or 4 times, and it lays in the field for 10 days. You pretty well have some junk hay out there. So one of the really surprising things that we saw was the more stockpile grazing that we did and the less hay feeding that we did, we were actually maintaining better cow body condition through the winter. And conventional wisdom at that time is, if you try to graze in the winter, your cow's going to lose a lot of body condition, and then you'll have to bring them back on hay. We found exactly the opposite. And surprisingly, we in the West here now, we have clients who have quit making their alfalfa into hay, and they're swathing it, and they're grazing swaths all the way through the winter, and basically they have the same experience, that it gets to February, March, and their cows are actually in better body condition grazing swathed alfalfa than they are when they're being fed hay. And the difference is really marked. If they have been feeding hay, in dry lot, as a lot of cows, they get dry lotted in the winter out here and fed high quality alfalfa hay. Well, just the confinement and not having the animals moving around, getting exercise, being in a more open, clean environment, their health gets better also. So besides the cost savings, we see improved animal body condition and also generally more improved health.
Sure. So we've kind of talked about a little bit of the culture of hay and how hay has been a part of our culture for a long time. You talk about in chapter number 2 of your book, the high cost of making hay. Was there a point in history where the cost of making hay made it worth your time, or has it always been kind of something that would have been better if we were grazing?
No, absolutely. There was a time when all of this mechanization, all of this hauling hay made economic sense. Now, I make the point in the book, and I very often say it at conferences, we did not get into the situation where we are today because our parents and grandparents were stupid. Why we're in the situation where we are now is because the basic economics, the relationship between input costs and product value has changed. The comparison that I like to use is 1973 to 2013. I use 1973 for one reason. That's when we got our first large round baler and really got into custom haying on a big-time basis. It's the year I graduated from high school. But something else that happened in 1973, we reached the all-time highest beef prices we've ever had in the country. And a lot of people think that the 2014, this hot price surge we had recently when fed cattle were all the way up, you know, to over $175 a hundredweight, a lot of people think that's the highest price we ever had because in terms of just nominal dollars, yeah, that's the biggest number we've ever had. But in terms of consumer buying power, 1973, inflation-adjusted dollars, 1973 is the highest beef price this country has ever experienced. Now, 2013 is 40 years later, and in 2013, we achieved record high beef prices. We didn't know they were still going to rise and, you know, go up even more, but they did. But I still use that 1973-2013 comparison because it's 40 years. We think about the age of our farmers and ranchers, and a whole lot of them have 40 years experience in this business. And so this is what we've seen. The general rate of economy of inflation in the economy says that input costs, cost of the baler, the cost of diesel fuel, labor, fuel, fertilizer, in inflation adjusted terms, input costs have increased at 3 to 4 times a faster rate than the value of the product. That peak, that beef price in 2013 to be on par with the 1973 price, fed cattle should have been $284 a hundredweight. What we actually were experiencing in with that nominal dollar highest price we've ever seen for beef, it was only 65% of the value that beef was in 1973. So input costs have gone up much, much faster than have our products and services cost. So I go back to 1973 and buying a new tractor, buying a new baler, baling up every bale of feed that you could so that you could run more cattle on your place made perfect economic sense. By 1974, though, we experienced the most precipitous drop in cattle prices in any cattle cycle, you know, before that time or since that time. And suddenly, even as 1974, it didn't make sense to bale up all that hay, but it took us a lot of years to actually figure that out.
What percentage of producers, in your experience, are running the majority of the year on leased land?
Oh, you know, that's a tough question because it varies a lot regionally. And I will say that, you know, over the last 40 years, that number has increased substantially. We see more and more producers who are running on leased land, and typically it's leased land with absentee landlords. As the rural areas have depopulated and many of the children of farmers and ranchers have moved to the city, the family has retained property ownership, but the generation, my generation, there's a whole lot of guys and gals my age who own some farmland or ranch land but have nothing to do with the operation of it. To say what percentage that would be, that information is available and I could look it up, but off the top of my head, I don't know. But it has increased substantially over the last 40 years, with probably a lot of that change happening in the last 20 years. And then, of course, we also are seeing investment by commodity investors in farmland right now because it's showing a better return than a lot of commodities are. We have people who are buying farms and ranches for hunting and recreational purposes. Some of them then rent that land right back to the farmer that they bought it from. So there's a lot of different ways that land is coming under ownership other than the operator of the farm or ranch right now. And I see that trend continuing to increase.
Yeah, so the land is the kind of the most precious resource, and I think it has always been that way, but it's, I think, maybe continuing to grow as far as the availability of it or the lack thereof, the lack of availability of that land, and that being one of the bigger challenges that we have, and what that grass is worth when somebody's willing to pay for it as a hunting property kind of makes it difficult sometimes.
Yeah, my wife was in the real estate business before we left Missouri, and she specialized in agricultural properties, tried to avoid residential stuff, specialized in agricultural properties. And we were already seeing in the late 1990s that rapid increase in farms in North Missouri, southern Iowa being bought for hunting purposes. And that is what floored the prices there. And even at that time, what urban people were willing to pay for an acre of land for hunting was well above what the agricultural value of that land was. Where we live in a very beautiful region in Idaho now, it is scenery that drives the price of land. And then location makes a difference. But there's very few places in the United States where you could actually buy a grass farm today that was priced according to its productivity.
Yeah. Yep. And so I want to continue on that line of discussion after we take a quick break to thank our sponsors. This episode has been brought to you by Chris Williams Audio. Check out his website at chriswilliamsaudio.com. For the last 11 years or so, I've been talking for a living. I've gained some skills in talking. I can form a sentence. I can think on my feet. I can respond to questions. I can come up with new questions. All that time developing my speaking craft has not left me a lot of time to figure out how to make audio sound great. If you're a musician, podcaster, or filmmaker, making your product sound great is crucial. So you stick to what you know and let Chris Williams stick to what he knows, making your product sound great. Head on over to chriswilliamsaudio.com for all your podcasting, music production, and film audio needs. Okay, we're back with Jim Garrish. We're talking about his book, Kicking the Hay Habit, and kind of some of the issues that go with that, specifically grazing as long as possible, if not year-round, and some of the techniques and different things that people have done, have been doing to do that. Before we went to our break, we were talking about the cost of land and how we can, or just some of the pressures that are being placed on producers relative to the cost of land. So what are some of the things that you see people doing to counteract that cost of land from a grazing standpoint or just to get access to that land?
Okay, so when you are working with an absentee landowner, you really need to know what that person's motivation is. If they are looking for property to have a certain appearance so that when they come there with their family, they say, ah, isn't this paradise? You might be taking a different production model approach than someone who is there saying, yeah, I want to milk this for every penny I can get out of it. So that's one consideration. You have to know what the landowner's true motivation is and then tailor your operation to really meet their goals. In terms of just in general with the high cost of land, this is one of the reasons why we see more and more beginning farmers, particularly young people with limited agricultural experience, wanting to get into the food business, the grass-fed beef business, the value-added dairy business, because they understand that they have to generate more dollars of revenue off of that acre than what a commodity operation is going to allow them to. We have learned over the years that as we increase the intensity of grazing management, we will increase the carrying capacity of that land. How much? At a minimum, we kind of see a 40 to 50% increase. Our best success stories working with clients are 400% increases, quadrupling the carrying capacity of the land that was being managed more conventionally. And so intensive management does require some investment in additional infrastructure typically, but if you can put that in place, generate 50% more, 100% more, 200% more revenue from the land while improving the soil and the pasture conditions there, a lot of landlords view that very positively. I seem to recall that you've already talked to Greg Judy in one of your podcasts. Is that correct?
No, he's definitely on the list, though.
Okay. I was thinking that I'd seen it there. You know, Greg Judy, most of the land that he operates on is either lease-free or very minimal amount because of the landscape improvement that he is providing to landowners. These are some of the other services and objectives that modern grazers need to be thinking about is what can you do for that landowner that Joe Blow next door isn't going to be able to do for him, and that creating a beautiful pastoral landscape, that is something that Greg Judy has become very good at, and it has earned him low-cost leases. He has land that, you know, he has been committed to him for his lifetime because of the services provided. That's totally different than anything we would have been thinking about 20, 30, 40 years ago within this industry.
That's exactly where my wife and I find ourselves as far as being a young producer, looking at the cost of getting into the business and trying to figure out how in the heck we're going to do it. And one of the things that I've been thinking is we need to go there armed with photo evidence of what we've been able to accomplish in terms of improving the land with the animals that we are bringing to the leaser. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is so easy to do in this digital age, you know, with GPS spotting of locations that you want to document over time, that you can just do a photo stream from the same place to prospective landowner who you're looking to lease their property and show them, okay, this is what we've done in X number of years to this property. Beautiful. Exactly what you need to do. The more you can document the changes that you have made, the more powerful you become as a potential tenant for someone who actually cares about the land and has those kind of objectives.
Sure. Is there a time of year when the animal's impact is more beneficial than another, specifically dormant versus grazing or growing season?
This really depends on your environment. In a dry land range environment, allowing a full season, growing season of recovery, and then grazing in the winter is one of the best ways to increase species diversity, create litter. You know, one of the challenges we have in rangeland is growing enough in a season to create litter to put on the soil surface to help the water cycle so that we can grow more forage in the next cycle. It's much easier to create litter in a dormant grazing event than it is an active growing season event. So dry land range, I'm going to say, if you can shift something to more winter use, allow the full season of growth, that's a good time to use grazing as a tool to enhance the resource. We come to a wet environment or irrigated land in the West, and then we have opportunity during the growing season to grow multiple cycles of plant growth. And if we focus our intensity of management in the growing season, it's going to allow us to have greater net photosynthesis through the growing season, which means we have generated more total biomass, both above ground and below ground. So using well-managed grazing as a tool is more powerful during the active growing season in a wet environment, but it's very powerful as a tool in the dormant season in a dry environment. And, you know, one of the issues that I have with some of the other grazing gurus around the country is they seem more comfortable taking a totally dry land management concept and applying it to wet country and vice versa. And there are, even though their fundamental principles are the same, there are enough differences in the rate at which things happen. They happen very fast in a wet environment. They happen very slowly in a dry environment. We do need to have a different approach to the management of time, whether we're in a wet environment or a dry environment.
So that young producer that is looking to go out and take some pictures of the you know, before and after pictures and probably over a period of years, can you give us some tips and tricks, recommendations as far as how to gather that information?
Okay, you do want to have a defined point, a defined reference point, so that you have repeated measures. Taking only one picture a year at these locations really limits what you might be able to show. I like to see a picture taken in mid to late spring, one at peak of summer, and then one as you're transitioning from the growing season into the dormant season. If you do that within a year, you can illustrate where your management emphasis are going and what you're trying to do, and you can show not only potential landlords, but we can also show the anti-grazing people that if you look at what we're doing at one snapshot point in time, yeah, you might find something ugly. But if you look at it in the context of a full season, we can show you very positive outcomes.
Sure. Very, very helpful. You talk about the photo point and having a reference. This is a landmark, a tree, something like that. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Well, if you can work some kind of a landmark into the picture, that's great because the viewer immediately identifies with that. What I was referring actually more specifically to is using a GPS spot so that you know you're back to the same point. We used to do that. You drive a steel T-post in there or something. They rust it away. The cow rubs it down. It's unsightly in the picture. And so GPS is more permanent than, you know, putting some kind of field marker out there.
Right. And we're not just taking pictures shooting across the top of the grass. We're also taking pictures at predefined points looking down.
Exactly. Yep. Straight down in and the landscape view.
So that we get that litter, a picture of the litter increase mm-hmm. in those things, right?
Yep. Good idea.
Very good. Yeah. Well, and I appreciate your time today. Just got a couple of more questions. Obviously, I've got many more, but we could go on for a lot longer, but I don't want to keep you any longer than I said I would. But I do appreciate your time today. So thank you.
You're welcome. One thing that I would add is I think keeping, formal grazing records, so you have documentation of, and the unit of measure I use for everything is AUDs, animal unit days per acre, but track the productivity of the land. That is a two-edged sword, though. With a landowner, if he or she sees that you've increased by 50% or 100%, the AUDs taking off, they might want to raise the rental rate. I know that has happened to Greg on several occasions and other people I know who made a conscientious effort at land management, made improvements, have had the landowner raise the rental rate. But when you go to the next landlord and you are able to show that you were able to take someone's property and in 5 years' time double its productivity, that does make a prospective landlord, you know, more interested in your services.
Sure.
But for your own benefit and knowing what you're accomplishing and what has it cost you to accomplish that, the grazing record is very important.
Sure. And so you're in Idaho now, and that climate is obviously different from Missouri in relation to kind of the, am I correct in saying the winter is different in Idaho than it was in Missouri?
Yeah, in our view, Idaho winters are infinitely more pleasant than Missouri winters ever were.
Is that less ice?
All because of the humidity.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I'm in Missouri right now at our daughter's, and it has dropped 30 degrees in the last 4 hours, and it is just bone-chilling cold here. For Christmas, we were down at our son's in Texas, and we drove down there. But when we left Idaho, I think it was 10 degrees the morning we drove out. I got down there. We were about 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. We arrived. It was around 40 degrees, but it was a bit overcast and the wind was blowing. And I was the coldest I had been, you know, through the winter so far. When I stepped out of the truck down there in Central Texas at 40 degrees compared to 10 degrees in Idaho, you know, in Idaho it gets cold. We expect it to stay cold. We might have continual cover for 3 to 4 months, but it's rarely ever more than 10 or 12 inches deep, and, you know, cattle could graze through it. In Missouri, it could be 70 degrees one day, 10 degrees the next day, 18 inches of snow the next day, and then 3 or 4 days later, the snow's all gone, and you got a mud and a flood. So, yes, the winters are different, but it's opposite of what most people, you know, would want to believe.
Sure. Yep. So what recommendations do you have for young producers? We've talked about taking those photo points and some of those things, showing what you can do for the land. Just getting started, you know, what are we looking at? What are some of those things? You talked about grass-fed beef, about value-added dairy, some of those things. What are you seeing as some of the best methods of getting started?
Okay. You're located out by Belfouche, is that right?
Yep.
Okay. I suspect that your market for humanely raised, environmentally friendly, grass-fed beef or anything else isn't that high just because of where you live. So you have a marketing challenge. That's not to say that, you know, it can't be done. You just have to around Rapid City, I suspect there's a demographic there who does want to buy that stuff. And so if you want to go into the food business like that, you have got to be really diligent in identifying the market and focusing your efforts on that market. For young producers who want to get started in the food business, one of the biggest mistakes that I see them making is their reliance on the farmers market, because it takes a lot of time to do farmers market, and a lot of times your sales aren't very significant. And for dollar return, I think it's one of the worst things that you can do. Unfortunately, I can't tell you exactly how to identify what the market demographic in your area is. In a lot of states, I do know that the Extension Service, they have done quite a bit of marketing evaluation, and in some states they can be very helpful on getting young people plugged into the right segment of the community for that. I will definitely say for young people, don't be in a hurry to buy land. Have you read Alan Nation's book, the Land, Livestock, and Life book?
I have not.
Okay, so Alan wrote, I don't know, 12 or 13 books. The LLL, as we call it, is what I think is the best of all of those. And a point that he makes in there for beginning farmers is where you actually want to start is develop a profitable livestock business on somebody else's property. So don't try to own land. Don't try to own livestock starting out. What Greg Judy did, custom grazing on leased land, that is the lowest risk way of getting started in ranching. All right. Once you have established that, then you think about owning your own livestock, but still on somebody else's property. And the last step is actually buying land. Because land primarily has value, when you purchase land, its primary value is as an appreciating asset. As a production platform, owning land is not at all essential. Controlling land is what matters. And I talk to a lot of young producers who they contact me and say, hey, we bought this 120 acres and we would like to do this. And when you, unless you have outside wealth that has allowed you to buy that land free and clear, and you are honestly able to treat it as an investment, that is the worst starting place that you can be in. If you've bought a piece of land and you're making payments on that land, you have no money left to invest in livestock. And it is the livestock that is actually going to generate the income that ultimately will allow you to invest in land.
Sure. And that goes along with some of what I've been seeing, that the limiting factor in a lot of the leases that we have is the control issue. We don't have control over how that land gets utilized on some level. And so we've already been trying to identify some of those leases that are open to giving us a little bit more control. Is that a deal breaker for you as far as lease land? And I think this will be my last question just because we've already gone over time. But is that a deal breaker for you as far as lease land is concerned, whether or not you have the control?
Okay. Are you putting that forward in terms of the duration of the lease, or that you might have the leased land, but there's other activities that can be taking place on that property?
Like, we don't have control over when we can be there in the year. We're there basically, you know, until they say we need to get off, which is usually around the time the growing season starts and those things.
Yeah, to me, that's kind of a deal breaker. It sounds like what you're describing is a lose-win scenario. You're losing, the landowner's winning. Again, both Greg and Alan would emphasize that you need to find landowners that you can develop win-win scenarios with. Once you have developed a win-win scenario with a landowner, they are usually interested in keeping you around as a tenant. What I see as a terrible challenge is the difficulty for a beginning farmer to get anything more than a year-to-year lease. You know, for some people in your situation, a three-year lease is a big deal. It's a winning deal. And Greg is, and I keep referring to Greg, you talk to him sometime, and I mean, he'd be a great interview for you, is I don't think he looks at anything anymore if he can't get it as a seven-year deal. Maybe someone else, you know, that I've recently been talking with. But you can afford to do a lot with land improvement if you know that you've got a commitment for at least that seven-year deal. I think that was somebody, not Greg. I think Greg might be saying 5 years.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like an important key to me, that issue of being able to control it and graze it the way that you need to graze it so that there is improvement happening, so that you can, over a period of years, increase the stocking rate and some of those things.
Yep.
Well, I think obviously we've left a lot on the table as far as stock water and you know, the fencing infrastructure and different things like that. And I'd love to have you back on another time in the future to pick your brain some more. I appreciate your time today, though. So thank you very much.
You bet.
Well, how can people keep up with you and see where you're going to be next and get a hold of your books and the fence materials through? How do people get a hold of you for those things?
So there's two good ways that you can keep up with the workshops and programs that we're doing, and then also the services that we provide to American Grazing Land Services. We have our website, which is AmericanGrazingLands.com, and then we also have a Facebook page also under American Grazing Land Services.
Okay, very good. Links to all that, Alan Nation's book, Greg Judy's book, of course, Jim's books, and the American Grazing Land Services website and Facebook page will all be, again, at workingcows.net/20. So, again, thank you for your time today.
Cool, and thank you.
This episode has been brought to you by Kamak Ranch Supply. Check out their website at kamakranchsupply.com. Here's the deal about Kamak Ranch Supply. When you call and ask them about a product, there's no blank pause on the other end of the line because they don't understand the product that you just asked them about. If they are selling it, they understand it because they are producers, and Gary Kamak himself, the owner of Kamak Ranch Supply, is a producer. So if you want answers about the products you're calling to ask about from producers, call Kamak Ranch Supply or check out their website at kamakranchsupply.com. I appreciate Jim taking the time to sit down with me for that interview. Just a valuable wealth of information, somebody that is really great to have around as a resource that we can continue to draw from, and I look forward to future opportunities to connect with him. Coming up next week on the show, we have a quite a bit different episode, and that's all I'm going to say about that for now, but we also have a bonus episode coming up at the end of next week with another one of the featured producers for the South Dakota Grassland Coalition's Grassland Planner. So we'll see you twice next week, and I look forward to it.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.